power or service? What is it? What's it going to be? Well, it's the news, according to me. Good morning. It's Thursday, November 13th, 8:23 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, and I am, it's 2025, by the way, the year. I am your host, Kevin. I am not a doctor. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a financial counselor. I'm a guy with a lot of opinions. And it just so happens this morning I am not a guy with a live show. I'm not sure exactly how this is going to work out. I think tomorrow morning will be a good day for a live show. Today would have been, I'm prepared for a live show today. I actually had everything prepared. So I'm going to treat this as if it was. The only thing that's different on a live show is it's a little bit harder to do the intro because I have to have the show on for a little bit to get anybody a chance to kind of realize that we're on. I don't put out posts saying that the show's going to be at such and such a time because I'm not very, very good at SEO. So if I was better at search engine optimization and all the promotional stuff, if I had a staff to work on that stuff, it would be much better, but I don't have that. A lot of these guys that look like they're sitting in their kitchen doing their shows actually are not in their sitting. They're sitting in their kitchen, but they have a staff. They have all kinds. And I've looked into this at one time, and I may do this in a couple of years after I retire from my current position. I may start to develop some kind of a production facility. I've always wanted to do this. With the current facility that I have, I have this office space, shop space thing that I've got. And I could rent it out or I could turn it into a creative type of hub type place where there could actually be some there's got to be, you know, there's more than one way to generate revenue from a place like that. Of course, one obvious way is just to start a business there or to rent it to another business that wants to use it to run their business out of, which would also be perfectly fine. Could do that. Be a good form of make it useful, making it productive, and then I could probably also what I'd really like to do is start a. I had an opportunity a few years ago. It was probably 7 or 8 years ago. There was an old TV station that TV and radio station, and it was actually. Right, not too far from my house, about 2 miles away, 2.5 miles. It was for sale, and it went on auction, and it was sold for almost nothing. It was a ridiculously high value property, sold for a tenth of the price that it should have sold for, because nobody knew about the auction. I just happened to be driving by and found out about the auction, and I stopped in. If I'd see that, if the same thing would happen today, I would own it. I was not in a position to own it at that time. It's since has, I think it's flipped several times. A bank actually ended up buying it. My bank actually ended up buying, which was kind of frustrating. I think they would have backed out if they saw that somebody was actually going to purchase it. But they ended up watching it over because I drive by there all the time, and I kind of ended up watching how it's developed. And it's the one company that they really put a lot of money into the place. They came in and turned it into an office building. The place was a pretty interesting place. It had a studio for doing video. It was a rather large TV studio, and they had all their cameras and stuff in there, which was a large kind of an auditorium, but a larger area where there was. Production facility, and then there was these smaller booths for doing voiceover work, like a foam padded rooms where you could go in, and there was a smaller room for doing smaller production work, video production work, more like a desk type thing, like a news anchor type thing, which is kind of interesting. It was the whole thing could have been used, and then of course there was a meeting room. There was a lot of other office space, a lot of offices there. My whole vision for the building was. That it could be a place where you could have a community center where you could be people would kind of have a membership there that different creators in the area, whether they be businesses or whether they be whatever they be individuals, whatever craft hobby craft type people, they could come in and do a they could have a YouTube video blog or stream, do live streaming, all that kind of stuff. Because all of the high-tech stuff was wired to the building. It was all already there for doing extremely high stream internet, that kind of thing was all there. And it was just a little perfect little place for that, in my opinion. But that was kind of my vision for the place. So you'd have this community building where people could either, you know, just come in and rent time in the studio to produce a video or whatever they want to do. Or they could come in and they could have a membership where they would have access, you know, on a regular basis to the facility. And I still think this is a viable idea. In fact, a friend of mine who's in production work, he does movie production work, he's actually looking into doing something like this in where he lives up in Michigan. It's northern Michigan. Having a facility like that, doing something like that. And we just kind of happened off the wall, get into the conversation about it. And it was kind of funny that he had the same kind of vision that I did. So we may still work on something like that eventually as time goes by. Because there is a need for high quality video and audio production for people who are doing, YouTube creators, the whole YouTube, just any kind of media creators, social media creators, whether you're doing whatever you're doing, photography for Instagram, whatever it is that you're trying to do, just to have access to those kinds of facilities without having to pay for all the money for the professional use. And there could be people there that would actually help you do those kinds of things. So the part of the membership would be that you would have, studio technicians that would actually help you and a team of people you could put together. And people could share resources that way. So you may not have enough money to pay for someone to put together show content, but you might be able to share, you might be able to pay somebody for an hour to do it. Well, somebody could have a full-time business in that facility with doing show content creation. And that could be their little side business inside this place, helping people, because there's plenty of office space to do that kind of thing. People could set up a little, shingle there and have their little workspace. It could be a side gig for them. They could just come in on weekends or evenings and just put all this information together for the people doing their shows. It just the whole thing would kind of come together as a community, church groups, whatever, any kind of organizations that would want to do something promotional. They could do those kinds of things and make it quality and professional and do the whole thing properly. That was kind of my idea. Now the thing is, the facility I have right now could become that. On a very smaller, much smaller scale. I mean, there's much, much smaller amount of space. I think that the 10,000 square foot building compared to my 2,000 foot square foot building would makes a huge difference. But it could still be done on a much smaller scale, and it could be scaled up later on. If it's successful, it's probably a better way to start it is in a smaller scale like that, and then just to build it from there. So if it can be done, and that's kind of what many times. People get these visions of grandeur, thinking that the only way they can do it is to go big and do all this big stuff. And that's not where God has you. It's kind of that, the whole thing where I think God has spoken to people in the past. He says, "What's in your hand?" You're looking for something else. What do you have in your hand? What do you have in your hand that you can do right now? I've had many times in my life where this is kind of been the case. Early on, I'll tell you a little life story here, and we'll get into this whole thing. I got some audio we're gonna get into. It's gonna be a long show, so settle in, take a look at your cup. I happen to have chai with Almond Joy creamer. It's already gotten cold, and I also have a backup cup here, which is kind of interesting. I went to a place called Hacienda last night. It's one of those places where they microwave everything, but it's supposedly Mexican food. There's only a few of them in the region, I think, here, but they have good sweet tea. Occasionally they have good sweet tea. Sometimes their sweet tea isn't as good as other times, but this is a night where they had actually good sweet tea. So I did get a sweet tea to go, and I have it right here in this little cup here. So anyway. on with the story, the life story here thing. I've never been one, which sometimes is good and sometimes is bad. I've never been one to wait around for something, for someone else to provide me with a job. In some ways it could be considered a defect or something's wrong with me. I don't have really any fear. I don't necessarily have a fear of failure in terms of business type thing. There's plenty of other things I fear failure for, but it's not when it comes to business. The prospect of just all you have to do is read stories about people like Sam Walton. Let me look at this. I'm going to look at something because I think this is kind of telling. This is here we go. Let's go over here. No, I don't want to use that. Let's use this right here. Right there. Let's use this tab right here. Warren Buffett. Now there's a guy named Munger. I think it was his buddy. So was Sam Munger? What was it? What was his name? Warren Buffett and this other guy, Munger. So Buffett and Munger started Berkshire Hathaway, and they both are, they're still good friends to this day. Now they're both in their 80s, 90s, whatever it is. Let's see if I can find. I don't know when Buffett. His life story. I'm gonna see if I can find this. He was born August 30, 1930. He's almost 100 years old. I didn't realize he was that old. He's 95. He lives in Omaha, Nebraska. Doesn't live in New York. Doesn't. He's an American investor and philanthropist who currently serves as the chairman and CEO of a conglomerate holding company, Berkshire Hathaway. As a result of his investment success, Buffett was one of the best-known investors in America. According to Forbes, as of May 2025, Buffett's estimated net worth stood at $160.2 billion, making him the fifth richest individual in the world. Buffett was born in Omaha, Nebraska, the son of a U.S. congressman and business, Howard Buffett. He developed an internet interest in business and investing during his youth. He entered the Wharton School of the University. So he's got a good education. In 47, he graduated from the University of Nebraska. He went to graduate in Columbia Business School, Benjamin Graham. So he kind of there began his various business ventures and investment partnerships, including one with Graham, Benjamin Graham. He created Buffett Partnership Limited, his firm, eventually Berkshire Hathaway. Charlie Munger is the guy's name. In 1978, fellow investor and longtime business associate Charlie Munger joined Buffett as vice chairman. Now, Buffett emerged as the company's chairman and major shareholder in 1970. In 78, he really didn't. He was an investor, and he did things in business, but he never really made it anywhere until he was about 60 years old. Now, this is according to kind of a documentary that he has. I guess he has some kids. He does have three kids. I'm trying to find out here. I'm thinking it was 1990. When he really came on the scene, as it kind of busted onto the scene, now he's been a chairman. Of course, he's had a good income, but his personal investing in where he's come from. Now, what you don't realize is that he owns a lot of things. Berkshire Hathaway and some of his other side corporations and side businesses as well. And he lives off of his stock options and everything else he has. He doesn't get paid. He's famous for saying my secretary has a higher pays a higher tax rate than I do. And he's come out and made some political statements like that, very carefully invented stuff like that, where he said things that it's disingenuous because it's actually kind of deceptive. If he was making a salary, he would be paying higher tax rate than his secretary. He was kind of saying that to take a dig at rich people don't pay enough. That's kind of the innuendo that people have used. However, it was also a dig to say that, you know, he's so smart that he can get away with paying less in taxes than his secretary. So that, I think that's, you have to understand where these people's, where their egos take them and how they say things. That's kind of part of the whole issue here. But basically, let's see, what is this? Warren Buffett accepted a job at Benjamin Graham's partnership. He started, his salary was $12,000 a year, about $141,000 in today's money, a six-figure income. Back then, $12,000 was a lot of money in 1954. You could buy a house for $12,000 easily. There were houses selling for $6,000 or $7,000 back then. You know, that's back when, you know, people just didn't make that much money. It just, gas was 20 cents a gallon. Just a very different world. And of course, the stupid tax of inflation has happened. There are a lot of people who are saying that the only way we can reduce inflation, the dollar value, the dollar value can go up, is by putting us into a recession. A recession is the only way out of this situation that we're in, where things are so high. That is not the case. You can have a deflationary economy, and this is, it's only happened a few times in our nation's history. Now, I'm not an economist. I'm not a doctor. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a financial counselor. I'm not an economist. The thing you have to understand is how this works. If you look back at, now Nixon did a lot of things that screwed up our nation for over the long haul. We're kind of, when you look at what happened with us unpinning the dollar from the gold standard, silver standard, however you want to look at that, an intrinsic standard. Of course, now it's pinned to oil. Fortunately, at least it's pinned to something. It's a fiat currency. It's not, you can't exchange it for anything other than just products and goods. And you can pay taxes with it. That's what actually gives it any kind of authority. But money itself, just started doing weird things. Initially, everything looked fine. We just unpinned it from the standard. Everybody would just be okay with U.S. dollars based on its good faith and credit. Nobody ever thought to look ahead 50 years and what might happen with the country, you know, worldwide in terms of whether our good faith and credit would remain for eternity. And of course, that's what whenever you have instability, anything can change, anything can, you know, happen, pandemics, World Trade Center, you know, whatever, economic collapse, economic, you know, downturns. and downturns always happen, and recessions always happen. So it's part of our culture. It's part of the way things work. There will be a next recession. There will be, because it always happens. Typically, it's it's a 7 or 8 year cycle. Plus, there's other cycles that go within that. So that every third recession is a deeper one. There's all kinds of things like that. People study those kinds of things. They can tell you more about those. I'm not going to tell you about it. But the way this works is that even Warren Buffett wasn't the richest guy in the world, one of the, you know, top 10 richest people in the world, until he was like 60 years old, I think, is when he started in with this whole thing. But he owns a lot of things. He has kind of crept into the RV market in my area. I think Forest River, I believe, is what you see. I believe it's Forest River. He owns a large share of Forest River. I think it's Forest River. It's either Thor or Forest River or something, one of the other groups, Lippert Components, all these other things that are out there, Dometic, all these businesses around the area that are heavily involved in recreational vehicle market. And so there's, of course, they buy up different smaller companies, and that's, they conglomerate everything, and they kind of, and that's kind of what's happened in this area. It's kind of interesting. Somebody will come out with a new trailer or a new RV of some kind, or a trailer, you know, it could be even a horse trailer. And they come up with this idea and they start building it. And then what ends up happening is they start to push into the market. And what happens is one of the bigger companies will come in and buy them out. They'll buy out their idea and they'll just offer them, here's $1 million, walk away. Whatever it is, or $10 million, whatever it is, and walk away. And that's kind of become a side gig for some people around here. There have been several people who've made their fortune by coming up with an idea, putting it out there on the market, and then selling it out. It's actually happened probably a dozen times in this area where smaller companies will sell out like that. It's been happening over the last 20 some years. So it's interesting to see that all happen. Now, the where I was going with all this, I don't even remember. I honestly do not even remember what I was talking about before. But the life story here, this, you have more opportunity, more independence, but with much more risk involved when you try to start a business. When I was a youngster starting out in the aviation world, I just had this vision, this goal, this burning desire to become a pilot and become, I wanted to become a mission pilot. I wanted to work for MAF or JARS or something like that. I just saw myself out in the jungle somewhere flying an airplane around. And that's not the path I took. That's not the path that really kind of opened up for me. It never really worked out. Now, it still could. After I retire, who knows? I might end up in a jungle somewhere with an airplane. Who knows? But the whole, and or I might work for the organization. I might not even be, a jungle pilot. I might end up just working for them. Who knows? I didn't want to sit around and wait for a job. This is back in the 80s and early 90s. Airlines were not hiring. Oh, they were hiring, but it was tough to get in. They would hire maybe 100 people a year back then. And it was just difficult getting a job anywhere. There, this one of the things that I kind of heard somebody say this one time, and I hadn't really thought about it until I heard this. It was a corporate pilot. He was flying for a decent company, flying a small corporate jet. And we were in a meeting one time just talking about things. And I was a fueler at the time. I was a ramp technician or line tech, they call it. I fueled the airplanes and I moved them around and did stuff like that. And that's while I was learning how to fly. So I was working for the airport for the fixed base operator. And during that time, we had this little meeting in this guy's office. And of course I was all mesmerized by anything that was, aviation just seemed like this big deal. I remember looking inside of a twin-engine airplane that the FBO operated as a charter operator. It was called an Aztec, Piper Aztec. Of course, I was learning how to fly a single-engine airplane with just, minimal stuff in it. And that was overwhelming enough. I just peered inside this airplane through the window, looked at all the stuff in there, all the controls, all the dials, gadgets, levers, switches, and dials. And just thought, wow, I'm just never going to learn all that. There's no way I can learn all that. Well, just a matter of years later. And I also remember the same kind of thing happened with a jet airplane. There was a jet that pulled up, and it was a Gulfstream 2. It was a G2. Pulled up on the ramp one night, and it was I think this was probably in 1992. I remember it pretty well. This guy who was not much older than I was had started off in his aviation career right out of high school. I don't think he went to college. He got in with a charter company. He started flying like Aerosmith and Elton John and all kinds of people around. Well, they had just gotten back from a deal where they flew somebody around. He flew this G2 into our little local airport. Because there was a guy who owned the airplane and leased it to this company that he was working with. So he ended up landing this thing one night there, and it was, I happened to walk up inside the airplane, and it was kind of giving a tour of the thing, and walk up inside there, and I looked up to the cockpit, and I just remember that just seeing the complexity. Of course, this is back when we call it, steam gauges, what we call steam gauges. No computer screens, no nothing like that. It was all, you know, levers and dials and just electromechanical stuff. Nothing digitized. This is back before we had iPhones or anything like that. No iPads, no iPhones. A lot of paper charts. And it was overwhelming. It was to the point where I remember looking at it and not knowing, I didn't even know what I was looking at. It was that overwhelming. Just huge panels with lots of switches. And just, you know, of course, now that I understand it better, I understand how they lay things out for, they might have the pressurization system, the air conditioning system might be in one area. They have a hydraulic system. They have electrical system on all the panels that they have and all this stuff. I kind of understand all that now, but it's kind of understand. I don't, you know, but the, you know, I go from that point to becoming an instructor in general aviation, small piston engine airplanes, twin engine airplanes, to getting involved in an airline, eventually becoming an instructor for the airline, teaching people how to fly, going from piston engine airplanes to flying a jet airplane for passengers in a 121 operation. But I never sat back and waited for that to happen. I remember to this day, I was sitting in the FBO, I was pumping gas, I was doing my thing, and a new operator came in. Somebody else bought the place, bought out the fixed base operation. And they brought in an instructor, and he had all his certifications and all that stuff. And I was, of course, the gas pumper guy trying to work on my certifications, trying to get my CFI. And eventually, there wasn't anybody hiring. I didn't see a way to get, you know, just nobody. I'd go around, knock on doors. Nobody was, it just didn't seem like there was very many opportunities. And one of the things this guy said in this one meeting, okay, I'll get back to that. He said, you know, there's only so many seats in an airplane, only so many pilot seats in an airplane. And that has always kind of stuck with me. Because if the local area only has 12 airplanes, say the local area only has 12 corporate aircraft, well, that's 24 seats for pilots. 24 pilot seats and only 12 captain pilot seats in a community of, you know, whatever it is, 200,000 people. Well, it's the competition's pretty high for those seats. So I can either sit around and wait for one of those seats to open up. Who knows how long that's going to take? Or I can go out and start my own thing. So I started my own thing. I started my own flight school. I had a little 150, Cessna 150. Scraped together the money to buy it. It was an old run-out, junky-looking little thing. Made a lot of money with that thing. Let's say I had a lot of money go through my pocket with that thing. A lot of money came in, a lot of money went out. But I built a lot of time in that thing, and I also ended up buying a small twin-engine airplane to do multi-engine aircraft instruction in. I didn't buy it. My dad bought it, leased it back to my company, my flight school. Made it profitable, and then we ended up getting, at one point we had eight airplanes under our pilot there. We had several 150s. We had a couple of, had a Piper Arrow, a couple 172s, had a 182, had a little tail dragger 150 Aerobat, and did a lot of aerial advertising as well. So we were able to tow banners, do that kind of thing. Very busy time from 1993 all the way through 1996, 97, something like that. Very, very busy. And learned a lot, made a lot of mistakes, made a lot of good calls, good bad calls, whatever you want to call it. Interesting time in aviation life. Until finally, all of a sudden, I kind of out of the blue, I got a call from an airline, a regional airline, that just happened to be one of my former instructors. A couple of my former instructors worked there at this little airline, and they were kind of talking to one of the fleet managers there, and he kind of told him, "Hey, you should call Kevin. You should call him. You should call this guy. Needs to work here." And finally, guy just called me out of the blue and said, "Hey, if you send me a resume, I can get you an interview." And of course, I went to the interview and I got a job. I was flying for a corporate operation at the time, full time, and it was a much better deal. I had a great job. So I kind of went to this interview, kind of thinking, well, it's not that big of a deal, they don't get the job. It's kind of fun to go to the interview. I ended up being the only one who got an offer, and it was kind of a. From that point on, it was just kind of skyrocketed from there to for the next few years. So anyway, the point I'm trying to make here is that I've never been one to really just sit around and wait for something to happen and try, you know, I'd be willing to make something happen. Sometimes that's good and sometimes it's bad. Sometimes you can step off into a direction that God's not leading you in. And you have to kind of have some trepidation. You have to have a little bit of, I think healthy trepidation in certain things. But there are people who have always sat around. I've known people who wanted to start businesses, had an idea for a business. They've had it all thought through. They had the money. They had everything to go. They just never had the guts to take the step off that pier kind of thing. And you talk to them 20 years later, and they look back and wonder what could have been. Now, life didn't work out badly for them, necessarily. But they always wonder, you know, what else could have possibly happened if I would have done, you know, where could that have gone? It could have gone belly up. Now, the way I looked at it, see, I didn't go to college. I know people who have spent $80,000 on their college education, or $100,000, or $200,000 on their college education. And they're paying off those student loans for a long, long time. And it becomes a grind. It becomes a grunge. It becomes, you know, the job that they're doing, even if they're working in their career that they want to do, it becomes this thing where they still feel like they're just bogged down in it. Now, you can do it that way. Or you can go out and just try to do the business that you want to do, learn what you need to learn, and chalk it up to your education. Well, I lost, you know, $20,000 in that business. But you know what? I would have spent $20,000 for a year of school or whatever it was. And I learned more actually doing it than I probably would have learned in school. I know people have gone through 4 years of college, gotten their bachelor's degree, gotten their whatever it is that they get. They get their business degree. And they step out of college and they can run things. They can be a manager in a business. That's different than being an entrepreneur. There's the true entrepreneur. Entrepreneur. There's an entrepreneur who will go out and buy a franchise. People call them entrepreneurs. Oh, you're an entrepreneur. It's because they own a business, or they run a business, or they're manager of a business. I know a guy like this. This is we had one at our church for a while. He was his family owned a business and he took it over. He did not start the business, but he ran the business, and everybody called him an entrepreneur. He's an entrepreneur. And I agree that to some degree, yes, you're an entrepreneur. You're a businessman. You're venturing out. However, there's a difference between that and someone who will take from scratch with what's in their hand, invent or create something or start a service business of some kind from scratch with their own elbow grease, their own investment, their own vision in their head that becomes a reality. And that true entrepreneur spirit, if you want to call it that, with a small s, actually, you know, does its thing within that person's life. And become, you know, you take that vision from nothing, from ether in your head, to actually physically doing something and having customers calling and money crossing the table. And it may or may not make it. You're the one taking the risk. You're the one out there taking that challenge. And I think it's a different kind of entrepreneur. when you buy a franchise, one of the things I could do in retirement, I could just go ahead and buy a franchise, you know, start a restaurant, something like that. You know, just go out and say, okay, I want to start a Chick-fil-A over here. I'm just going to put the money into it. And, you know, you put up a certain amount of money, you buy the property, you do all this. I think I was looking into some of this stuff and so like to buy a franchise for, I think, was it Arby's? Something. There's different programs that the franchises have, turnkey type operations, where they come in and they do all your training, they do all this stuff. It's a kind of interesting way to do it. But you say I want to put up $100,000 of my own money, and of course sometimes the restaurant will have financing available, so they come in with this financing, they put everything else in for you, and you have to run the show the way they say to run it for the next however many, you know, years, whatever it is. But some of these managers from these places are, you know, they're making multiple six figures. There are some Chick-fil-A managers who, now one of the things Chick-fil-A does, they require the owner to be the operator. So you need to be there. So you have to put a certain amount of time in at the actual restaurant, which is why you don't see very many Chick-fil-A operators. You don't see them starting more than one store at a time. They might have an annex. So some of them have a main store, a main restaurant that's for the public, and they might have an annex at a college or something like that. They might have to do something like that. Sometimes they do that, those kinds of things. But normally it's a one or one off. And Chick-fil-A doesn't like to have one person running multiple stores. And typically, some of these people, after a while, after 4 or 5 years in business, they're making $1 million a year. The managers are. So it is a very interesting business model. Now, is that person an entrepreneur? To some degree, yes, of course. Is it the pure spirit of an entrepreneur? I would say there is a higher level or a different level of entrepreneurship. Somebody who starts now, name one thing that Warren Buffett has invented that he started that he took to market. There's nothing. He's been an investor most of his life. He's been the guy behind the scenes providing the finances, and he's very disciplined in that respect. But that's not an entrepreneur necessarily. In my opinion. Now, having said all of that, we talk about the free and open market and the difference between socialism or communism, democratic socialism, and the open market or the capitalist mentality in an economic situation. I've talked about this before. Bernie Sanders always talked about this is the richest nation in the country, richest nation in the world. This is the richest nation in the world. Why can't we afford health care? We have a healthcare crisis, a housing crisis. We have all those. We're the richest nation in the world. There's always going to be a crisis, and Bernie can always use the people who like to use that kind of rhetoric. They like to play against. They like to play class warfare. What's happening in New York, for example, with Mamdani and some of the other places? There's this thing I want to play a little bit later. There's this one. I somehow got to change gears here because I'm going from one thing to the next. But let me know what you think about all this stuff. This is kind of I think that we're losing some things in our educational system. Of course, our public education is not designed to make people business people. It's not designed to make you a businessman. I didn't learn anything in high school that necessarily, other than social activity and some things about math and a few things about bookkeeping. I took a bookkeeping class for, you know, just general bookkeeping. And that did help me out initially starting out in the business. I owned my own business by the time I was 19 years old. Started a public business in town, had a storefront, whole thing. Had a karate studio. Taught Taekwondo. At 19 years old. Now, I had started some other small businesses when I was a kid, doing some things, just doing small weird stuff. But that was the first real business I had. Now, my dad was in business most of my life, but I always remember he was doing something. When he was a young guy, when I was just a young little toddler, my dad used to, his former Amish kid, he never joined the Amish church. My grandpa actually left the Amish church before he had a chance to join. They were conservative Mennonites, and they didn't have televisions. My grandpa didn't have never had a television in his house. But my dad became a television technician. He fixed televisions. He understood them so well. Of course, then he worked for a company called Canned Sun Dryers and all kinds of stuff. And he did he was always doing some kind of business related stuff. He owned a business when I was in high school. He had a small marina, ran the marina. He was always working on sales stuff. He was always kind of working on a get rich quick stuff. It was kind of got caught up in some things like that. There were some kind of business opportunities where he was always doing a side hustle. And it was all because he wanted to provide for us, but he was always doing something like that. And unfortunately, I got that gene. And of course, my uncles, his brothers, same thing. They all ran their own businesses. They all had stuff going on the side all the time. My one uncle was a plumber. The other one was at an auto parts store. Yeah. I guess you could say they're industrious. Anyway, so one of the things that was going on here was that I always kind of had that kind of in my background. It was, I guess maybe that's why I had no fear of that. Now, it also gave me a different perspective on money. And of course, I was never really taught much about money and investing and all that kind of stuff. I've kind of had to learn some of that on my own. It's been an interesting venture. I've had a couple different employers kind of tell me that. One of them told me they were frustrated with me because they didn't understand what motivated me, because they couldn't motivate me with money. They tried to offer me more money and it didn't matter. I've been more of a principled, and it's not necessarily a virtue. There have been times where I've walked away from jobs because of I didn't feel like I was treated fair. And I just walked away. It's always kind of worked out for me, but at the same time, I'm not necessarily sure that was the best answer in those situations. I think but the making the money didn't matter to me. It was more a matter of principle. However, there's also another way of looking at that. There was other ways I could have handled those things. I could have probably stood my ground and fought it out and had the tenacity to say, hey, I'm not going to leave here, but I'm also not going to work for this. We're going to get this straightened out. We're going to work, this needs to be worked out. I don't know. We can go toe to toe with those situations and actually face up to them. And I was, but that's my thinking was I take the stand, I make my statement. And if they don't agree with it, I walk out. My little dog is laying on his back. So it's so funny. Got his paws up in the air, laying on his back. He just looks funny. So I ended up, I got to change gears here for now. Because the show's almost over and I got a couple things I want to get into. There's some audio here I want you to listen to. Because the name of the show is going to be basically Service Versus Power. One of the things that this lady, I don't know who she is. I don't even know what her name is. I see her constantly on CNN and MSNBC. And so she's got a podcast of some kind, maybe a video podcast. Very outspoken. She's kind of the vulgar, kind of the answer, I guess, that the left is looking for somebody who has direction and is willing to speak it out, say some things. And I just unfortunately, to me, she seems kind of she's just vulgar. It just and it just bugs me to no end when people act like this just because they can, I guess. But here she is. This is now the main point that I'm going to make here is that this is one of those people who is just an example, and I see this from the left all the time. They like to bring up scripture. They like to bring up Christ-like. This is not Christ-like. They like to preach to us and tell us what Christ is like. They like to tell us what scripture says. They like to throw those kinds of things in our face. All the while, they live nothing. Nothing according to scripture whatsoever. But all of a sudden, we're supposed to be okay with. We're supposed to listen to them. Oh, we're being preached to. We're being lectured now by someone who is going to tell us what it means to be a Christian. And obviously, they have nothing but disdain for Christianity. But they know all about it. Oh, they've read the Bible. Well, they've read maybe a verse of the Bible. You can't tell me they've read the entire Bible. Some of them will say they have. They'll say that. I doubt it. I seriously doubt it. There are a lot of Christians who haven't read their Bible. So in the process of all this, this is what this lady's saying. Of course, now I've heard Gavin Newsom. I've heard several other people make kind of comments like this. And you can tell when they start talking about it, whether or not they are really truly a believer or not, or if they're just somebody who just wants to throw something, what scripture says this? The left commonly does this quite often. So I'm going to play this. This is kind of an audio of, I'll set this up a little bit. So this lady, she's talking about Riley Gaines. Now, one of the things she makes this little comment in here that I want to really highlight because it has nothing to do with this whole idea of the left throwing their little self-righteousness in our face and telling us, you know, how to live as Christians, their disdain for Christianity. But I want to point out something that she says in the middle of this because there's a subject here. There's an underlying subject that I want to get to. And it kind of gets to the whole thing of democratic socialism and everything else that's going on. So let's just listen to what she has to say here about Riley Gaines.
One thing I want to say about Riley Gaines, as she sits there and has the moral high ground against AOC, when I look at people, if I were to say who's more Christ-like, mm-hmm. I would pick AOC and the atheist Jew Bernie Sanders and the Muslim Zoran Mamdani a million times over you, Riley Gaines, because Riley Gaines, all you do is hate on people.
Now, she's saying that they're more Christ-like than she is, more Christ-like than Riley Gaines is. Now, get this. All you do is hate on people. That's what she said there. Let's just continue on. All you do is hate on people.
You are wound up like a cheap clock over trans people. You show them no grace, no compassion. You defend billionaires. You cheer and celebrate when children are zip-tied. And then you have the audacity to get on television and try to lecture people who fight for the people that are suffering.
Now, understand, she's the one doing the lecturing right now. This lady right here is the one doing the lecturing. She's getting on her show, getting on TV. She's the one who's giving the lecture. Riley Gaines, I don't know that I've ever heard Riley Gaines give a lecture on anything. She shares her personal opinions on things. I don't know that she's ever actually done this, where she attacks people and starts going after them like this. But I'm sure this lady thinks she's more Christ-like, because she knows. Because she knows what Christ-like is. She knows what Christ-like should be. Because she knows Christ, personally, apparently. Well, not. So, and she, it does surprise me that she makes the distinction here that in understanding, most people don't talk about this. Bernie Sanders is Jewish, but he's also an atheist. It's a very interesting little thing there, but he doesn't talk about that very openly. It's funny that she brings that up.
That stand and put their arms around people that need sanctuary, and you try to act like you're better than they are.
She's not saying she's better than them. She's just saying they're wrong. They're wrong. They're breaking the law. They're wrong. No, it's the people who are out there virtuing with their virtue, trying to protect the downcast and the downtrodden. They're the ones who are saying they're better than us. Better than, just like this lady right now is saying, because she's berating Riley Gaines, and basically, and the whole thing about, and we're just keep it.
You're an insufferable twit. Nobody likes you, and no matter what, you will
nobody
always
likes you.
Have been the dumb that tied for fifth place, and the only place that you can get a job is at bottom feeder Fox News, you insufferable twit.
Now, this is the lady who claims she knows what Christ-like, the definition of being Christ-like. And she's doing this. Can you see the juxtaposition she's put herself in here? Are you actually looking for someone to be Christ-like? Is that what you're looking for? And you're saying that this is an example of, if I have to look as well and be Christ-like, oh, those are Bernie Sanders and AOC are more Christ-like than you are. You insufferable. Proceeds to call her every name in the book. Because she's taking the moral high ground here. She's the one who's so morally correct. She's going to tell us how to live.
Nobody likes you, except for the other
nobody likes you.
Christians that enjoy in their spare time watching.
Now, listen to this. This is really critical that you listen to this, because this kind of gives you an idea of what she thinks about Christians in general.
Likes you, except for the other fake Christians that enjoy fake in their
Christians.
Spare time watching children get zip tied and then sit there and justify it while they read the Bible with their hideous crucifixes around their necks. So
their hideous crucifixes around their necks. Now, when she says crucifix, you know, there's some people just have crosses around their necks.
But that's Riley Gaines. Finally, if you think this Zoran
now,
thing is happening.
This is another example here. This is where she goes on about, she likes the fact that, I can't remember this gal's name. She's out there and she tends to walk around groups that are protesting and she asks them questions. And this is one where she's doing that. And this lady comes across somebody who thinks that it's great that Charlie Kirk is dead. She's glad he's dead. She's glad he was shot. She thinks he deserved it. Because of misinformation. This is just what people think about Charlie Kirk because of what they're what they're told about what Charlie.
Finally,
and it's so that this lady says something. She's asking her questions, and this goes on. You probably heard this, but now this she thinks this is great the way this lady responded to the person who was asking her the questions.
Finally, if you think this Zoran thing is happening just in New York, and you think people are waking up only in New York City, you're mistaken. Look at this clip of a wine mom at the No Kings March. Play the clip.
Edward's name was?
Charlie Kirk, ma'am?
Yeah, him is horrible. Horrible.
Charlie Kirk is horrible?
Yes, I'm glad he's not here.
You're glad he's dead?
Yes.
Why would you say something like that, ma'am?
Because he was horrible on the campuses, the college campuses. Horrible person.
You know what? I do the exact same thing.
Well,
would
so
you be
sorry.
Glad if I would die?
Maybe. I'd have to think about it.
You should be ashamed of yourself.
You should be ashamed of yourself.
Your friend just said she'd be happy if I died.
So now, listen up.
Now listen to how she responds to this. She thinks this was cool the way this person got back in her face.
Democratic establishment. You can either jump on board with this shit, or we're coming after you in the same way that we come after MAGA. Period. Stop.
So she's a radical leftist here. She's talking to the Democrat establishment here, people like Chuck Schumer and Joaquin Jeffries. And she's basically saying, we're going to treat you the same way we treat MAGA if you don't straighten up and fly right. That's fascism right there. That's not democracy. That's your, you know, get on with the program here or we're going to start demeaning you and running you in the ground and wishing you were dead. That's what this amounts to. But I digress.
Taking AIPAC money. Go on an I'm sorry I took AIPAC money atonement tour if you want to stay in power. Stop.
Right there is the statement that I want to get. Now, first of all, she talks about AIPAC, which is the basically the Jewish lobby, Israeli lobby in Washington. They take money from that. Now, listen to that part. She says one little thing in here that I want to make very clear that there's a distinction about this.
I'm sorry I took AIPAC money atonement tour if you want to stay in power.
If you want to stay in power. This is where we have a problem in our culture, in our leadership political culture, in my opinion. This is at the crux of the issue of our political discourse. The idea of power. Who is... Should politicians have power? And in a representative constitutional republic, politicians should not have power. They should have representation. They should be servants to the people. It should be servitude. They should be the servants. We shouldn't be their servants. They are our servants. Collectivism has a very interesting path that it goes down. And we'll talk about this more in my little series I'm trying to put together with the whole thing of the difference between democratic socialism and free market capitalism. But we'll have, let's just say, when she says this, the word power, she means it. This is what they think they are in power. This is one of the biggest problems we have right now with the Democrat Party, is that they want power. They don't want to serve the nation. They want to have power over the nation. Look at Mom Dami. Look at his entire thing. He wants to be a king by promising you all kinds of things. Free this, free that. Your rent's going to go down. Your buses are going to be free. Food's going to be low cost. All because of me. I'm going to take care of all of you. I'm going to be the benevolent dictator. Because they have power. Well, if they have power to do that, and they have power over your entire life. That's where we need to stop giving them power. They are our servants, not our overlords. And that's the issue that we're running into right now with our government's culture we have in government right now. Now, I'm going to continue to play the rest of this because it's important. We're going to get to this point where we're going to talk about the DSA and what's happening there a little bit.
Stop missing out on these big rallies. Hakeem and Chuck should have been front and center introducing the next mayor of New York City, but no, they wouldn't show up because they're beholden to the same corporations that helped Donald Trump get elected. And this is just an embarrassment. Kudos to Bernie, to AOC, to Zoran. And that woman out in somewhere middle America saying, Charlie Kirk, he was a racist, he was a piece of shit. There are so many more of us than there are of them. And these Democrats that continue to play patty cake with corporations and lobbyists, nobody wants that. Nobody wants you. We want politicians to speak freely and look at what the benefit is. Look at what is happening in New York. And you dipshits are sitting on the sidelines, running your social media like complete dorks. It's embarrassing. Get it together, Hakeem and Chuck. Seriously, get it together, because the Democratic Party is moving on. We are moving on.
Now, tomorrow, I am going to be putting, I'm going to talk about the DSA. I was going to talk about the DSA, the Democratic Socialist Association. I was going to talk about that today. I'm going to talk about it tomorrow. In fact, I'm going to save this audio for tomorrow, I guess. How can I do this? I'm going to do that. Just delete that. Put that on there. Yeah, that's what we're going to do. The In fact, I'm going to just let me do this while I'm thinking about it, because otherwise I'll forget about it. This is the kind of thing that's going on. The difference between power and servitude. They want us to be the servants. You can only have one. You have to realize this is, you can only have one or the other. And I think that the, sadly, it's, I probably should put this down. DSA, let me just do that. I'll put DSA on here. Just do that. There we go. There we go, folks. Hey, by the way, this is, there's no advertisement, but you have to put up with me doing this kind of thing once in a while. Let's see what happens with that. So this is what happens here. We have this whole thing of, I would say ideology, the war of ideology, this ideological war that we have going on right now, which is actually starting to become more kinetic. And that's what's getting a little bit concerning about all of it, is how much is going on with the radical. And they're just going to get more radical. They're going to get more and more entrenched in this thing, because hatred festers. It starts to become an identity. Most of these people identify themselves more and more as Trump haters than anything else right now. This is a problem they're running into, is that they have no identity outside of who Donald Trump is. That's where the left, I think the Democrat Party in general, especially the establishment party, they've lost their way, and because they only know themselves, or they understand themselves. When they look in the mirror, they see themselves as a Trump hater. They're an anti-Trumpist. Well, you can't be an anti-something for forever. Trump's not going to last forever. And so who are you? What is your identity has become something that is not attractive at all. It has no vision, has no plan, has no purpose. So you need to go forward with something, and they have nothing. And this is where the Republicans can step up and step in, if they can define their vision. Right now, the Republican Party, I mean, people say, who's running the Democrat Party? Well, who's running the Republican Party right now? I mean, it's Trump, yeah, okay, but who else? Who's in the wings? Who's really the person behind this, behind Trump, that we can look to? Now, we got several people who are very capable leaders. Don't get me wrong. There's, I think Marco Rubio. I think J.D. Vance is good. I think there's a lot of people there that I think are excellent leadership material. I like what Kristi Noem is doing. At the same time, I don't know how she is. I'm not sure that she's the best leader in the world. There's some personality issues with her that I think need to be addressed. There are some other lesser known females in Trump's cabinet, I think, that would be excellent as leaders. For one, I think Laura Trump, who's not even actually she's a Trump by marriage. Frankly, I think she would be an excellent, she could be president. No question about it. She has incredible leadership skills. I believe her and her husband, they are really the actual real Christians within the Trump family. I think they're much more biblically sound, in my opinion. Donald Trump Jr., I think, has the Republican, I think he's a little bit more conservative in terms of his Second Amendment rights thing. But he's a little bit more out there with some of his beliefs, I believe, in my opinion. Outside of that family, there's plenty of other people out there that are in the Republican side and in the conservative side that I think can step forward and be leaders. I think Senator Kennedy would be. He'd be a riot as the president. He's got all these little one-liners he's always saying. Aside from all of that, the show's gone long enough, I think, for now. I think that the interesting thing or the fun thing that we have to deal with here is how much longer can the left, you know, maintain this level of hatred, putrid, stupid, you know, just reactivity that they have to anybody who is a Trump supporter or who Trump is himself and just everything else that they're going through right now. It's just ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. Well, folks, the show has gone longer than I thought it would. I had this big, long story at the beginning, so that's kind of what took some time. Hopefully, it was worth listening to. Again, let me know what you think about what I think. 812-379-8778. Leave me a message or a text message. Ask questions. Say anything you want to say, whatever you want to say. If it's pertinent, I might put it on the show. Or I might take heed of your direction that you give me. Kind of ask questions or whatever you want me to talk about. So tomorrow's show, tomorrow morning, probably, it may be live, but I do want to get into this whole thing about the DSA, kind of, and continue to expand on this idea of power and service and the mentality behind leftist socialism and what real true open market capitalism is and why it's the best of the options. God bless, folks. Have a great rest of your day. See ya.